Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. On the December 9th meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we're going to start off. We've been in executive session from 7 to 8:30, but we're going to start off the public part with open public input. We have 20 people, and I think you're all veterans of this process before, so the buzzer will go off, and you know the drill. So I'll bring you up two at a time, and I'll start with Greg Larson and Steve Miller, please. And Greg, you'll kick us off this morning.
Lead off, huh?
Lead off.
Okay. I was going to come yesterday, but I didn't. But the reason I'm here today is plain and simple. I watched TVW yesterday. What I saw compelled me to take the time, get up early, and come here, because what I saw was a demonstration of something I've believed in for a long time. Leadership is something you do with people, not to them. I saw that done numerous times by the commission yesterday. So I want to compliment you, and specifically, I saw one of the commissioners take on the management team in regards to that new policy with Puget Sound. And my belief is he feels the same way. You lead with people, not to them. I saw one of the commissioners talk to a young lady who was disillusioned by some hard times maybe in her life and the situation with Heaven's Sake. He offered her the help of advising what she could do maybe to pick up some money for tuition or keep her spirit going. I was in the classroom for 30 years, and I know exactly why he did that. And I also saw every one of you, the anguish in your eyes when that Heaven's Sakes thing came up. And I can conclude easily, I think, that you all unanimously think that was wrong and it needs to be made right. So that's why I'm here. And the main reason beyond that is if I can see that from a closed circuit presentation 60 miles from here, think what it would be like if we could apply that across the whole broad spectrum of what this department does. I'm talking specifically about interacting with the tribes and the old North of Falcon process. I know there's barriers. We've talked several times. I have to several of you about that. But communication is where trust begins. That's the way I felt yesterday, and that's the way I feel now. So from me to all of you, thank you so much for what you did yesterday. Keep up the good work.
We can extend your 3 minutes if you want.
You get an extra 45 seconds. Yeah.
Thank you.
Myself too many times.
It's atypical we hear that, sir. Thank you very much, Greg. We appreciate that. And Ross, please, and Steve.
Thank you. I'm one of those folks that is not a veteran here. This is my first time. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some input.
The buzzer will go off. That's for you.
That's cool. I'll be brief. I'm here to put in some input about the suction dredge mining and specifically the inconsistencies in the current permitting process. As it stands right now, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I am new at this, it requires those of us who do, for example, restoration work on stream beds and creeks to get a permit, a hydraulic project approval, which I think is good. I mean, we can't have people running around planting invasive species or whatever. But the suction dredge mining people don't seem to have those kinds of regulations, even though what they do is, by definition, very disruptive to the ecosystem of the creeks. So my suggestion is that not that you should do anything specific, because I'm not familiar enough with the options available, but what I would ask you to do is do the right thing here, and which is level the playing field. if you're going to hold us accountable to go through the permitting process, and I think that's fair, then you should hold the same set of standards to anybody who's doing stuff there, especially stuff that is by definition very disruptive. So that's the end of my little spiel, and again, thanks for the opportunity to provide some input.
Thank you, Steve, and welcome for your first time here. Leland? And Ross, you're up.
Most of you have seen my graphs. I gave a copy to each of the new commissioners who probably have not seen it. Ms. Tammy says you all will get a copy of these graphs of some of our animals in Willapa Bay. I'll talk about the non-salmonid ones in the open session. I'm Ross Barkhurst from Nema, Washington. Life member of the Washington Waterfowl Association. Our waterfowl continue to be at 35-year lows in Willapa Bay. We don't have a recovery plan for them. The department has stopped surveying them. And it's a sad state of affairs. Down to 8,000 last year, and my estimate is 14,000 this year. Herring spawning mass is down to zero in Willapa Bay and Grace Harbor. There's no recovery plan. We did survey them this last winter and found zero spawning. I've not been able to get a copy of the report or any recovery plan if it exists. I suspect that neither one of them exist. I don't like doing the FOIA thing, so I don't have it if it exists. And at this point, I would say, you know, a newsflash headline, WDFW authorizes removing the base of the food pyramid in Willapa Bay. That's what's going on. The green sturgeon are ESA listed. Their main forage is burrowing shrimp. We have a supplemental environmental impact statement that the public has reviewed now to see if we want to write a permit and do some more of it. Okay. The department had no comments on that EIS. I checked. It's incredible. It's just incredible. Major part of the food pyramid. White sturgeon in our bays are at historic lows, and so no retention is allowed. That's their main food in the bay. Marbled murrelets are ESA listed. The young are starving in their nests for lack of forage fish. I can stand in my old growth timber with the binoculars and watch them spray their spawning beds to kill the eelgrass. Now we have a proposal to kill the burrowing shrimp that survive. Also, eelgrass removal is under an NPDES permit, and it continues. There are some really shady circumstances how the testing was done on that. You all contracted to observe that test. Your people were removed from the test. And they brought in a fellow who, it turns out, violated the state ethics code and on a state computer was selling shellfish to the people who wanted that permit while he was testing the permit. So, last but not least, I'd just like to say that should we get another burrowing shrimp permit with a quarter-mile exclusion area around any place where the burrowing shrimp are sprayed, how on earth can you all set a fishing season or a crabbing season or a clamming season in the bay? And the spray window would be just like it was the last time. You'd be spraying where people fish. And you had no comments. You're allowing spraying of state-purchased waterfowl habitat, which is habitat for the birds in the bay. And this department handed those maps to ecology.
Ross, thank you.
So that's why we have a confidence crisis. The last curve that you haven't seen before on my handout, this is a curve of the WDFW comments to protect the ecology in Willapa Bay. It's a blank sheet of paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. And Steve Franson, please, and Leland for the benefit of our newer commissioners, I said they're missing your visual aid.
I'm here because I don't need the signs anymore. No more picket signs. This is a great day, man. We're all happy here. Really happy because we finally got a Skagit spring steelhead season. And thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. It's been a long time coming. Standing in the cold water, holding picket signs, casting rods with fluffs of yarn on the end of it, playing like we're fishing, hoping the cops would come down, hoping for the newspapers. It's been great, and I want to thank you all for that. And but I've heard rumors that there's no funding for the spring season. Now, come on! How can that be? Say it ain't so. You're saving money. Close the seasons. Should be money around. Should be money around. We need to have the season. We've got Carrie over here who's has terminal cancer, and the guy needs to get in the river. He needs to get fishing. We need to have something. We need to get Carrie out there. It's very important. But more important, we need to have this season. Back to the funding, if that's an issue, then I pose this question. How much do you need? When do you need it by? And is there a mechanism for public monies to go into this? Is there a mechanism for all the clubs? Is there a mechanism for the organizations? Is there a mechanism for GoFundMe to fund the money that's needed? So the only questions really are, how much, when, and can we do it? Can we make this happen? Because there are people out there that will make this season happen. You've done your bit. You've got us the season. If you need help, let us know, but don't just sit on it. And if you got money hidden, don't sit on it. That's all I got to say.
Thanks, Leland.
Yeah. Leland, don't off for a sec, please.
Yes.
I'm in your way. No, not coming from me, trust me. Can we get this fellow some answers? Can we assure him that we will get him some answers?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to do everything possible to have that season this year, and we'll be out there monitoring with resources that we have. We're going to make it happen. If we get the approval, it's going to happen.
Fabulous. Thank
you. Leland, you are going to want to get the director up there. I don't think he's ever had the pleasure of being on the Skagit, have you, Jim?
No, I have not fished the Skagit. It's one river I have not.
Let's make it a group.
It's majestic.
Group hug.
Let's have a party out there and let's go fishing this spring.
Sounds great.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Leland.
Thank you. Charles Sullivan, please, and Steve.
Good morning, Commissioners, Director, and Mr. Unsworth. You've just undermined half of my testimony, but I appreciate that.
Thanks for coming.
that's great to hear that it's going to happen. You know, it's the ink isn't really dry yet. It's almost there, but we've got the NIMS evaluation under the 4D rule was supposed to be ready today, but I only got it last night, and so I've got a small, slow printer at home, so I only have one copy with me, unfortunately. But that's one step in the direction. The EA is in the works, in the pipeline, as they say, as will be the biological opinion, and then Regional Administrator Barry Tom, who I actually used to work for, is got it. I think that even I'm hopeful that without threats of broken arms or kneecaps or anything, that the signed approval will be on your desk in time to issue the regulation reinstating that season, in which case I'll have an open seat in my boat. And
seats?
I have a small boat. But,
I don't like this.
Okay.
So I have an idea. Director, you can do double duty. You can do the monitoring while you're up fishing.
Yeah. We, But in addition, and I hope planning, you know, okay, monitoring is going to be one of the requirements. One of the things that is still unsettled is the fishery. What is the season? What are the regulations? In the proposed plan, the RMP specifies February 1st to April 30th. That's fine. The proposed fishing area is just from the Dallas Bridge to Marble Mount. That's a little less than half the area we had prior to 2010. It would be nice to have all of that area, and since Skagit and Stille have been closed since the end of last January past, you must be sitting with scads of money for monitoring a larger fishing area. And the entire river can't be open as it was in the past because of the concern about the Nookachamp steelhead, but I'm thinking a fishing boundary. The decades-old boundary was Gilligan Creek, which goes 4 or 5 miles above the mouth of the Nookachamps to protect, we could double the area open on the Skagit by including the area from the Dallas Bridge down to Gilligan Creek, but not below that in order to protect those Nookachamps fish. Just wanted to share that. And thanks much, but job well done for the most part, folks.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Wayne Klein, please, and Charles.
So I'll keep this short. I thought I had a lot to say, but it seems as though there will be funding for the fishery, so all I have to say is thank you.
Thank you. And Kurt Kramer, please. And Wayne, you're up.
I'm Wayne Klein from Mount Vernon. I, too, would like to thank you guys for getting this Skagit catch and release season going. A lot of guys have said, we've talked about this funding thing, I think if it's going to happen, maybe you guys could let Brett Barkdahl know. He seems, last time I talked to him, he was a little bit panicked that he said, you know, I don't know how I can do this with the staff I have. So, and some other people in the department have worried about it too. But we'd like to help. If you guys need help, just let us know. Let us know. Another thing that where we would like to help you is we understand that your budget proposal got turned down last time. We would like to try and do something about that. There's got to be some sportsman-friendly people up for election and unfriendly or sportsman-unfriendly people who maybe need to be voted out. I don't know if it's in your interest or if you can say publicly who these people might be, but as one of the commissioners told me when I first started talking to you guys, is go to the top. So we want to go to the top. We want to get you guys a friendlier boss if we can. But again, on this Skagit catch and release season, we're on the one-yard line. It's first and goal. You guys got to call the right play. No interceptions. So, and please get the cutthroat game fishing season out of the North of Falcon process, please. I'm selfish. I'll admit it. I want to retire. I don't want to move. I want to fish the Skagit River until the day I die. So help me out. Help all of us out. That's something else you should come and partake of is that cutthroat fishery in the lower Skagit. It's awesome. And I think I mentioned last time I was here, I've been doing it for 25 years and have never hooked a salmon fishing for cutthroat. Never. Not once. So I don't know how we can be hurting them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I think all you guys that came up from Mount Vernon must have been partying on the bus. Yeah. You're all good spirits this morning. Rod Parra, please. And Kurt.
Again, good morning, Chairman, Director, Commissioners. I came here to talk about the Occupy Skagit, but I'm just going to second what these guys are saying. Thank you very much. And I'm going to talk about something that's a little less pleasant, and that's the new Chinook Management Plan for Puget Sound. I'm going to zero in on the Stille Guamish, and I want to zero in a little bit more than that. Clearly, the Stille Guamish Chinook are in massive trouble. The most recent data that I saw on your management plan was that the recruits per spawners on the wild Chinook and the Snoqualmie is 0.65. That's put three fish on the spawning ground, you get two back. Even a senile biologist like myself realizes that's a prescription for disaster. I mean, something needs to be done. I've read your plan carefully, spent a considerable amount of time in the last 5 or 6 days looking at it, thinking about it, and I have a couple comments. One is, you had 7 years to do this, and this is what you got. I'm sorry, but you got to do better. But I want to zero in on the hatchery 12% cap. As you all know, Puget Sound Chinook fishing is reliant on mark selective fisheries. That's how we access the abundant hatchery fish and minimize the impacts on the wild fish. This one provision by itself will hamstring selective fishing in Puget Sound. Consider, for example, you're talking about a 12% cap on Chinooks. If we release a wild adult Snoqualmie Chinook, you have a 15% survival. That means if we catch 1% of the wild Snoqualmie Chinooks in a recreational fishery in Puget Sound, we will use up 6.67% of the 12%. We'll use over half of it for every 1% of the fish that we catch in Puget Sound. The 10-year average is that the recreational fisheries had 4.2%, so you're talking about reducing Chinook opportunities in Puget Sound if you're looking at adult Chinooks by 75%. That's real substantial. I don't like coming empty-handed. I do have a solution that you could get by with this, is if you quit marking those hatchery fish, you would release them all, and instead of killing 6.7%, you'd only kill 1%. They only plant 220,000 fish. If you quit marking them, you'd be ahead of it, and you can move forward with that. Unfortunately, you've had 7 years to work on this. If you'd have been a little more proactive and thought about this 3 or 4 years ago, you could have those fish already unmarked, and we could move forward into this new era without having a massive impact on how seasons are being scheduled. As it is, we're going to have a very difficult time for the next 3 or 4 years. It's unfortunate that but it seems that salmon management is just incapable of attacking any issue in a proactive fashion. The other provision in the plan that I have massive concerns with is what to do when the Chinooks return at a less than 9% level. That's a terminal run size at 9%. Looking at the numbers, the next decade, it'll be very unlikely you'll have any returns that'll be as high as 9%. Your plan calls for developing additional guidelines for Chinooks at those kinds of low levels. I'm presuming this will be a lot more conservative, so the impacts of this plan would be much more substantial than what people think about. This is a very sad day. I get in this business for my grandkids, and I've failed. I'm extremely sad. I've failed. I take great shame, and I've failed my grandkids in protecting the Puget Sound Chinooks. Unfortunately, the agency, the commission, and your tribal Comar workers are also complicit in that failure, and it's an extremely sad and shameful day.
Thank you. Yeah. Could you put your thoughts and your data, your numerical stuff, down on an email or a memo that we could have to review a little bit and discuss in more detail?
Sure. I mean, ultimately what needs is some serious modeling in various scenarios. You've got marvelously capable modelers to do that. So I'll give you my back envelope assessment. I'll gladly do that.
Thank you. And Lisa Baranek, please. And Ron?
I'm Ron Para, talking for myself and the Evergreen Fly Fishing Club. Mainly, we're talking about the rules proposal. It just came out in November. It's very, very difficult. We've been working on this for a number of months because we heard something about what it was supposed to be, and we didn't like it. These are the changes that the club has proposed for rules on the Snoqualmie system. That was the only thing we could work on. Everything else was huge. Our club has worked hard to develop these proposed changes to the EFFC or to the WAC, and this would provide opportunity while protecting the wild fish in the system. We want to see the regulations change. The summary is the changes are opening on June 1st instead of the first Saturday of Memorial Day. This would protect the wild fish, the smolt that are coming down, the June 1st opener. Also changing the almost all the stilly to a catch-and-release system, not a catch-and-kill system. There still would be hatchery steelhead. That should be there. Two hatchery steelhead, protect all the wild fish. And go back to the selective gear rules that have been added in some areas for more fishing opportunity. They were totally taken away this year. Some people have actually been up there and haven't seen the regulations, and they had their gear. The EFFC has actually put together the whack of what we would like to see, and that has been submitted, and of what it would be like in the whack and what it would look like in the regulations. I dropped off copies here that I was told you guys would be able to see. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Edward Atkinson, please. And Lisa.
My name is Lisa Baranek, and I live in Klickitat County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts today on suction dredge mining and the need for reform for it here in Washington State. I grew up in what I call subsistence fishing community in Michigan. I continue to fish to harvest when fish populations can sustain that. And stewardship was an important part of my upbringing, and it's an important part of my life and continues in a variety of different veins through my personal life, but also my professional life. As an angler, I see that current suction dredge mining regulations are not adequate to provide legally required protections for ESA-listed species or meet water quality standards under the Clean Water Act. My academic and professional background is in natural resource management. I've worked for the past decade in cold water conservation. Excuse me. I've worked in many watersheds protecting them, but in most cases restoring those watersheds for the proliferation of cold water fish. I'm very familiar with in-stream work, which entails varying levels of engineered habitat improvements or fish passage barrier removals. They all require plans and permits to conduct that work, literally in the stream. Not only are there planning and implementation requirements, but there are monitoring actions that occur as well. The same care should be applied to suction dredge mining, and this is currently not the case in Washington. This regulatory fairness or equal, the leveling of the equal playing field approach would protect millions of dollars and invest heavily in fish restoration in Washington for salmon, trout, and steelhead streams. I've literally watched people suction dredge mine upstream of projects that I've supervised million-dollar projects on. And that's pretty heartbreaking, to be quite frank. I believe there are opportunities for balance between future dredging opportunities and regulating mining to protect water quality, fish habitat, and legal requirements under state and federal law related to ESA and CWA. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Dan Spiker, please. And Edward.
Okay. My name is Edward Atkinson, and I'm from Granite Falls, and I represent the Evergreen Fly Fishing Club. And I'm new to this. I'm not a veteran of these kinds of presentations, but I do want to thank the commission for the opportunity to speak this morning. Those of us in the Evergreen Fly Fishing Club are very concerned about protecting wild trout in the Stillaguamish River. I'd like to quote two statements from the WDFW's own study entitled Oncorhynchus micus, Assessment of Washington State Steelhead Populations, dated February 1st, 2008. The first quote is, current information demonstrates that native resident populations of Omicus are often a component of the genetic population of steelhead. The second quote, genetic research is showing that healthy steelhead runs in Pacific Northwest streams are dependent heavily on the productivity of their stay-at-home counterparts, resident rainbow trout. So the WDFW's own study indicates that there's no genetic difference between wild steelhead and resident rainbow trout, and that the interbreeding of resident rainbows and wild steelhead is critical to maintaining a healthy population of steelhead. For these reasons, wild resident rainbows in the Stillaguamish River should be protected. Now, concerning cutthroat trout, the WDFW already protects coastal cutthroat in saltwater. We feel that cutthroat trout deserve the same protection in our rivers. So for all of these reasons, as Ron Parra also mentioned, the Evergreen Fly Fishing Club has submitted a written rule proposal to the WDFW for catch-and-release fishing on trout in the Stilly, except that two hatchery steelhead could be retained. And furthermore, you know, later on the agenda is going to be rule simplification. We feel like this proposal meets the spirit of rule simplification because it simplifies the rules for trout on the Stilly system. So those are my comments. And again, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for joining us. Tim Hamilton, please. Dan, good to see you, my friend.
Morning. Thank you.
My name is Dan Fletcher. Executive Director of the Washington Fish Growers Association.
I understand you're going to have a presentation on salmon net pens this morning, so I wanted to give you a little background on our industry. I started in aquaculture 43 years ago, using coho salmon in fresh water. At that time, we produced coho smolts to be transferred to saltwater. They were then raised to pan size in net pens in Puget Sound. A lot has changed since those early years. Today, the world salmon farming industry produces fish worth billions of dollars. The largest salmonid-producing countries are Norway, Chile, Scotland, and Canada. I remember when some Chileans visited my small freshwater farm in Rochester to find out how to raise salmon. Little did we realize that Chile would someday be the second largest producer of farmed salmon in the world, with production exceeding 700,000 tons of salmon in 2017. Initially, the plan was to produce pan-sized coho in net pens. However, over time, larger fish became more desirable. Coho only grew to about 5 pounds before they matured sexually. It was discovered that Atlantic salmon could easily grow to 10 pounds because of their longer life cycle. As a result, the industry around the world and in Washington State switched to Atlantic salmon. I've heard that Atlantic salmon constitute 95% of the salmon grown in net pens worldwide. There are significant advantages to using Atlantic salmon for production in saltwater net pens in Puget Sound. Number one, Atlantic salmon do not interbreed with Pacific salmon. Number two, scientists have failed to observe any Atlantic salmon escapees spawning in the wild on the west coast of North America. Number three, Atlantic salmon are conditioned to eat feed pellets. If they escape, they do not eat other fish or their natural foods. When the stomachs of most escapees are examined, they're empty. Here are some important facts about the fish raised by Cook Aquaculture in Washington. During the freshwater phase, they're raised in a disease-free, quarantined hatchery. They're also vaccinated against diseases they will encounter in saltwater. They are certified disease-free before they are transferred. Health is a critical factor in their growth and profitability. No example of the transfer of disease from farmed salmon to wild fish has ever been documented by regulatory agencies in Washington. Farm fish provide an important source of nutrition for the world. Aquaculture is one of the few real opportunities to expand the production of healthy proteins for our growing populations. Some people cannot afford to pay the price of wild-caught fish, and farm fish are their only option. Thanks. Answer any questions.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay. Tim. Okay. Next one will be Barry. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Swagger?
Yeah.
I kind of had a leg up on this deal because I had the opportunity to talk to this gentleman the other night on the phone, and we had a lot more than 3 minutes. I probably took up way too much of his time. But one thing that he told me, and you could probably go into it, that, yes, we sure don't want Atlantic salmon escaping from pens, but you told me that they were a year away from sexual maturity when they escaped. Would you like to go into that a little bit?
I'm sorry. They were
about a year away from
right. Maturity, sure.
Right.
They get them up to 10 pounds, and then they harvest them, and they basically fillet them and sell 2.5-pound fillets, which is the standard production strategy. That's about a year before they're sexually mature. So fish that escape aren't ready to go spawn. Typically, because they don't eat natural foods, they typically die or become seal food or whale food, and therefore they don't spawn in the wild. And that's been proven in all kinds of cases.
Okay, it was just a little ditty that caught my ear because there again, a year that they would have to survive before they would even have the capability of going out and sure. spawning. So
yes, it's true.
Okay, thank you.
Thank sure. you very much. Next would be Barry Bajerkian. I'm sorry if I got it wrong. I'm sure I have. Mr. Hamilton.
For the record, my name is Tim Hamilton. I'm the president of the Twin Harbors Fish and Wildlife Advocacy, which is a small nonprofit out on the coast. And I want to follow up with something that I find alarming. I'm going to follow up with the comments from Mr. Barkhurst. We have had a problem with fisheries management. We'll talk more about that at 11:30. But I want to talk about silos and the failure of the department to comment on that ESI. The ESI is the foundation by DOE where each of the agencies bring in their expertise and on which that permit would be developed. We kept waiting for the department because to protect the public health and safety, they require that you stop harvesting salmon, crab, shellfish, for a period of time after they spray due to the dangers to the public safety. Now, the permit that's being considered to be issued would be issued to the oyster growers who would choose the date, time, and place anywhere from April till December, right through all these seasons that the department sets. They can move them from place to place to place to place, unbeknownst to anybody, and they have to post a sign on a boat launch. That makes it logistically impossible, if that permit goes in, for this department to install a crabbing season, a commercial fishing season, or a recreational fishing season this year in Willapa without authorizing people to harvest fish that are considered unsafe for human consumption. It's a siloed effect. When the department chose not to do this, DOE, I doubt, understands what's going to happen. And I don't believe the department understands either. And seeing how North of Falcon is coming on it, I felt that I needed to share this with you today to understand this is a problem, a major problem. And I'm glad that they brought it to your attention because I don't want to face this in North of Falcon. I don't want to see this again. Something needs to be done. And this is what happens in my 35 years of governmental affairs on the federal and state and national level. I've never seen a default by a public agency that can just literally collapse another agency. That's why this thing is set up this way, so that this doesn't happen. But what happens when the department decides to go home? And that's where we're at. So with that, I thank you.
Staff comment on this. I recall when we had a briefing about spraying in Willapa Bay, we did have a department presenter as well as people from other agencies, and I was pretty concerned about the level of monitoring that the department was doing with it wasn't species by species. It was sort of family by family, and we didn't have really prior records to compare to. And now I'm hearing that there are these potential impacts to our areas of responsibility, and we didn't even comment on it. So I'd like to hear the department's perspective.
Chairman, Commissioners, I'm not sure if I have staff in the room that can answer the question right now, but we'll find out why we didn't comment or what our role was and get back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a similar question, but maybe, Mr. Director, we could look toward the end of the meeting during the debrief. I've been keeping a little what we call the Joe Store list. I see there are some of the Willapa experts back there in the back of the room, but maybe if they had a chance to think about this, and we may have some more public testimony between now and then, but maybe at the end of the meeting during the debrief.
Is that okay? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Don Wallace, please, and Barry.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity. I had intended to comment during the proposed rule changes comment period, but I'm happy to do it now if you'd like. It doesn't matter to me. Okay. So so I'm a PhD research fisheries biology biologist with NOAA Fisheries. Studied salmon ecology for over 25 years. But my comments today reflect my opinions alone and not those of the agency. I come to you as an angler, fished in Washington State since 1980 in marine and freshwater systems, and I use all types of gear. I strongly oppose rule change proposals number 10, which is all streams open unless listed as closed, and proposed rule change 13, which is unlimited catch and release fishing with baited barbed hooks combined with retention of two fish in all streams unless otherwise listed. I believe these two rule changes will put both threatened steelhead and a currently robust coastal cutthroat trout fishery at risk. The rule changes mean that more individual populations will be exposed to harvest, including numerous small populations throughout Puget Sound, Strait of Juan de Fuca, and along the Pacific coast. The number of fish intentionally harvested will increase, and the number of mortalities from caught and released fish will also increase. The problem for steelhead is twofold. First, Oncorhynchus micus, larger than 8 inches, are implicitly considered by this proposed rule change to be resident rainbow trout and not part of the steelhead population. As we just heard, the facts are that rainbow trout and steelhead interbreed in nearly every stream where it's been studied. Rainbow trout produce steelhead offspring, so reducing the number of rainbow trout will negatively impact steelhead populations. Second, fishing with baited barbed hooks will lead to high capture and mortality rates of small steelhead, even if they're not targeted. And these are the fish that have not yet had the opportunity to go to sea. At this life stage, rainbow trout and steelhead cannot be discriminated. The risks to cutthroat trout are similar and perhaps even more severe than for steelhead because they're so easily targeted and captured in streams. They're easy to catch. Since the 1990s, WDFW has very successfully managed for natural cutthroat trout populations. They've implemented catch and release with barbless artificial lures and flies. It's produced a very productive and increasingly popular fishery throughout Puget Sound, throughout the nearshore environment. It's working, it's popular, it's sustainable. Cutthroat trout in the marine environment are easily accessible. They live in very shallow nearshore areas. They appear to be able to handle being caught and released repeatedly. Some recent work by WDFW biologists and others have shown that. They appear to be able, the small and moderate sized streams that sustain the fishery can quickly be depleted under these proposed rule changes, reducing future opportunity for a fishery that now supports local shops, guides, restaurants, etc. throughout Puget Sound. These regulations may sell a few licenses in the short term for those who perceive additional opportunity, but the increased opportunity to harvest 8-inch and larger trout will be short-lived, and these proposed rule changes are short-sighted and ill-advised.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
And we have your NOAA disclaimer.
Okay, thank you.
Stephen Hahn and Don, welcome back.
Good morning. We all have a good evening. Did you all see yourselves on the news? You guys are announcing a bunch, I tell you. At any rate, Commissioner Thornburg, I really, any information you get on the Smithsonian and how they got their permits and did what they did, I'd like to know. I really, truly would. And I'll explain that because it's the way they got their permits was gone about in a complete opposite way from what I know and understand. Normally, it's like any proposal. You know, they develop the study and propose it, and you guys get it, and everybody approves. With the Smithsonian, when there's birds involved, first they go to the bird banding lab, and then they hand it off to a committee. They approve it. That's pretty much a sign-off. And then when you guys get it, you're seeing it coming from them, the PBL. So it's an automatic thing for the state to do something like that, especially when it's the Smithsonian name behind it. That's the normal way it would do. They'd go through it, and then they'd start the study. But this study that they took over, from my understanding, was at least a year into the research already. And what the Smithsonian, who they contacted first, I don't know. If they came to Washington State Fish and Wildlife and said, what do you got that we can take? Whether that was it or not, I don't know. What I'd really like to know. So all they did, Jim Kaiser, who was one of your biologists at the time, he headed up the study. The Smithsonian, all they did was take his study, which had been approved already, substituted invertebrates and put in birds. And that was it. That's really all it was, because they're basically were doing the same thing with the invertebrates, the caddisfly larvae and mayfly larvae and such that they wanted to do with the birds. And the real sad part about it, too, what the Smithsonian did, you know, I mentioned before, they banded 246 dippers. But the other birds that they banded, which were 84 Pacific wrens, when they didn't get the results from the isotope, a stable isotope portion of it, they just discarded that. You will not find any mention in their final study about the wrens or any other birds other than the dipper, because the dipper gave them numbers that they could use, even though those numbers were not real. And so it's just a weird thing. I'd really love to know how they did that, because it is backwards. And what I brought for you guys this time, my book, it's just a representation of, or a demonstration of, why I'm such an authority on the American dipper. Once you look at it, you'll understand.
Thank you. Mark Taylor, please, and Stephen.
Good morning. This is my first time to come to a commission meeting. What's motivated me to come out today was the recent release of the Chinook plan. I think you've heard from others already, and maybe there will be others to speak as well. Excuse me, but there's been a very high level of disappointment within sport fishing communities that I participate in the content, but also very much in the way that this plan was developed and distributed. A high feeling of disenfranchisement of the sport fishers that I've communicated with about this, and I wanted to be sure that view was clear to the commission and to the department. I am pleased that there are others here representing that same point of view, some of whom have already stated with a great deal of more detail about the specifics that I can't give you today. And so I'll leave that to them. But what I do want to say is to make very clear, my expectation is that within the constraints that surround this very complex management issue, that this commission and the department will zealously pursue access for the citizens of Washington State. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to hearing about this management plan, how did you personally hear about it, and have you seen it and been able to read it? And I know there is a lot of talk about what's in it, but which may or may not be all accurate. But just as a direct question, how did you get it, or have you gotten it? Have you looked at it?
Right. So just to preface, personal circumstances, I was out of the country for the last 2 weeks. But I did monitor some of the online communities that I participate in. And it would have been, I guess, 3 days ago at this point. That doesn't mean that's when it came out. That's when I noticed it. But it means that it hasn't been out for, it hasn't been on those communities for very much longer than that. When I discovered those conversations going on, there was an indication that the study would be on the department website. At that time, I went to the website and was not able to find it. I did find it last night. So, in fact, I have not read it entirely. I pulled it up this morning and was able to read through portions of it, but as you're probably aware, it's quite a long and involved document, and so I will not claim that I fully understand. And with that in mind, your point that what's being said about the document may or may not be 100% accurate. However, I do believe that my perception that there is a high level of disappointment in the community is backed up by the volume of comments that I've seen.
Thank you, Steve. And Melanie, Julio, please, and Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark Taylor. I am with Trout Unlimited. I also sit on the Washington State Invasive Species Council. I want to echo some of the comments made earlier about getting the department more access and flexibility in regulating suction dredge mining, in addition to the other comments that were made. They are also, because most other states are severely regulating or have actually shut it off, a lot more folks are coming to Washington State to do the activity, which is another vector for invasive species. The zebra and quagga mussels that we're worried about getting into our state, it could bring whirling disease in. Nobody's checking the equipment. Nobody's making sure that this vector is being even checked or noticed. So, again, giving the department more flexibility and be able to monitor and regulate this thing is good. I mean, this isn't the good old days. I've lived in Washington State all my life. You know, I was born over 50 years ago in Renton, and things are not what they were. They're not going to go back to what they were, but we need to keep what we've got and try and make what we have better. So, I'd like to also echo Dr. Berejikian's comments on the rules changes that in total agreement with that. Thank you much for your time.
Francis and Helen, good to see you.
Hi, good to see you guys too. I've come again today to talk about words. One of the things about me, I work for local county government, and I am an acquisitions person. And I'm going to start with acquisition, and we use that word instead of the word take, because that one sounds a lot nicer. So I want to talk to you guys about the word transparency and what the real word is. You guys are hiding things. So, you know, it's really about North of Falcon. And when we as the fishing community don't get involved and aren't allowed to be involved and can't see what's going on, there is a large lack of transparency, which we go back to hiding things. Transparency, open, honest. Hiding things, covert, theft. So when we talk about not being able to see what's going on, how about providing some kind of cameras, YouTube videos, TVW? Apparently the TVW video from yesterday sure hit the news, and transparency was definitely out there because of that, and I think that that's wonderful. But if we're going to have problems with tribal negotiations and they do not want to negotiate with us because it is on camera, something's wrong, because it needs to be open and honest, transparent versus covert and theft. Along those same lines, I have not heard anything about the Wainuchi settlement in a really long time. So back to transparency, open and honest. My other topics this morning are in regards to the spraying of the sand shrimp, the burrowing shrimp, and about how it affects other fisheries, and open and transparency about what's going on with that, and let's talk about it more. My other topic was the Atlantic salmon. I understand that it's a food. I understand why it's all done, but I'm back to transparency. When that whole thing happened, we all heard that what caused it was the storm, but then we also heard that that had a ball broken up before the storm. So which is the story? Transparency. So I'll leave you guys at that. I miss Miranda from the aspect of that I was going to invite her onto my new boat. The last time I was here and I met you all guys, I invited her to come on my canoe. She didn't seem too impressed. But now I've got a 20-foot Duckworth hardtop with seats. And our fishing has expanded. We've gone up to Swiftshire, so I'm not, like, pressured in the Chehalis, but it's still a real issue to me. And back to north of Falcone and transparency. Thank you, guys.
Robert Rao, please. And
Rayo.
And Dr.
It's hard to follow that. Spontaneous and extemporaneous speaking at its finest right there. I will just follow up on the transparency issue because that's what I'm here to talk about this morning. You know, nobody wants to be blindsided. No one wants to be left out of big decisions, big policy decisions. I mean, you yourselves sort of blindsided with this process, or lack of process in this case, putting together this Chinook Salmon Management Plan for Puget Sound. You know, I was involved heavily with the tremendous amount of work put together to create the Columbia River policy. We spent over a year and a half with you folks, and you were involved at every step of the way, okay? And this was just sort of happened out of the blue and dumped into your laps. It's a big policy decision. It's 10 years. I don't even know what the timeline is in our Columbia policy. I don't think we put a 10-year timeline on it. I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while. It's working, by the way. I'll give you kudos for that. But really, I will just part with these comments. You know, the public's getting tired. Enough is enough. You know, the process needs to be transparent, and I have some comments here that just fell off of my iPhone because it went into sleep mode. Enough is enough. You know, the public should not be denied transparency in what we call a public process. You know, the tribes, if they insist they don't want an allegedly disruptive public in physical attendance at these co-manager meetings. Now, they should be co. It's co-management. It hasn't been that way. It's independent management. And you try to come together at the end and try to make a mishmash of what each group wants to do. It just doesn't work. And we get left out. You know, seasons get cut, or they're delayed, or they're curtailed altogether. You know, the simple solution has been brought before you here already, and it's to video record these meetings. We don't have to be there, but they ought to be open. We have TVW. We have C-SPAN. You've seen the power of it today. A lot of these people are here today because of TVW being there yesterday. All right? Open and transparent public meetings. That's all we're asking for. Thank you very much.
Perry,
Chuck,
Robert.
Yeah, I'm here to speak also on a number of issues already touched on, and transparency is the prime one. The spraying of seven has been obvious to me as someone who collects sand shrimp for bait to have a detrimental effect on a number of the beaches that I go razor clamming on and beaches that I go specifically to gather bait for fishing. And I'm also an advocate for wildlife. I'm a wildlife photographer. I do a lot of work with birds. And the idea of transparency in the seven permitting process and the lack of transparency, I put directly at the feet of the director, Jim Unsworth. He has not been, you know, we all had a lot of high hopes when you came into the job. But the reality is that you have not advocated for transparency on any level. You blindsided these people on the salmon plan that you just released. You blindsided us all on the seven issues in Willapa Bay. And it's just too much. And I'm disappointed in your actions and lack of transparency, lack of enthusiasm for including us in these decision-making processes. My other issues are the tribes advocate for independent management. They don't consider us as co-managers. I have been told this repeatedly by people in the tribal fishing community. They have a right to fish, and we don't. That if the numbers drop low enough, we won't be able to fish, but they will. That's the end result of what's happening by lack of transparency in these negotiation processes. We need to have cameras there. They use the excuse that sportsmen are disruptive in the meetings. Okay, put cameras in. Cameras aren't disruptive, but they advocate against that. What's the motivation? We know that more than 50% of the fish are being taken in numerous fisheries by tribal supposed co-managers. It's not fair. We raise those fish. A lot of those fish are raised in our hatcheries. And we need to, like, get those fish back for the citizens of our state. You know, the tribes get it both ways. They're citizens of our state, but they're a sovereign nation. There needs to be accountability in this. That's what we're demanding. And personally, I don't buy the salmon farming arguments that were put up earlier by an advocate for the industry. He said that there's been no evidence in Washington of, in Washington studies, of transference disease from farmed fish to other fish. How about other studies? And studies that that Canada does are really slanted towards the salmon farming industry because salmon are a big part of the money-making process up there. And it's an invasive species. We don't allow any other people to put invasive species into our water. And the lack of transparency from them concerning the breakup of that farm should be a wake-up call to us all. Transparency is the big issue here. And we're all looking at you and through you, and we're going to hold you responsible.
Commissioners, we're well acquainted. I thank you, and I hope you had a good night's sleep after that arduous day yesterday. You guys take a lot of testimony. You take a lot of intake in these settings, and obviously throughout the rest of the year. And I know it can be, to me, it seems overwhelming. And I'm just advocating on one particular issue. So I'm sure for you, I just can't imagine how much you've got on your shoulders. You've heard testimony today about transparency, and we've had discussions about it, and you've heard my testimony to you before. We've had meetings with you. We've had public comments from you. We've had private comments from you about how you feel and how you support and how you say that transparency and open meetings in our fisheries are vital to trust and cooperation. I'm not going to take a lot of time and read comments or tell you about how important we feel as stakeholders, as the largest group of stakeholders, that transparency is to us. You've heard testimony on that already, and I'm sure you've gotten the emails and that. I will suggest something to you, that if you are truly heartfelt about supporting open transparency fisheries, I'm proposing to you that there is a very simple solution to this. and that is write it into your policy. Simply put it into your communication section of your policy that all meetings regarding fisheries will be open to the public. That way they'll fold under the Open Public Meetings Act, and then parties that are involved in those can choose whether they feel they're above the law and don't want to participate, or that they will participate as cooperation and good faith. If they choose not to participate, then they can explain to the people why they feel secrets are in the best interest of conservation. And that's really what this is all about. We need to come together as a group for conservation. Our fish demand it. Our fish need it. Thank you.
Vaughn Hodgkin, please. And Sherry.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the commission. My name is Sherry Stoiken. I am from Mill Creek, Washington. I want to thank you for your service on the commission and your dedication to the resources of the state of Washington and the people. I appreciate that. And also, I want to thank the people that have testified already. So you have people come before you who are very passionate about the topics that they come here with, present company included, and thank you for this opportunity. And sometimes I do know things get heated because I, too, come to these meetings and watch TVW. So, well, it's good to have a 10-year plan. The document on the Puget Sound Chinook management is only protecting the interests of one user group and in the harvest of the resources. And I've downloaded the document. I have it here. I have armed myself with the quintessential duo of Diet Coke and chocolate frosted Pop-Tarts, and I'm almost two-thirds of the way through this thing. So I am concerned that there was not user input on this. And Governor Stevens boilerplated the treaties, Medicine Creek Point, No Point, etc., that guarantees the treaty tribes the right to fish in usual custom areas alongside and in common with the citizenry of the state of Washington. We're failing on that. We have had the straits shut to us. We have had Puget Sound shut to us when there have been the other half of the user groups out there fishing. So Washington State is clearly violating the treaty that states that shall fish in common with and alongside. You're failing to allow us the opportunity to fish in common with and alongside. This is a treaty that both sides engaged in, and there's great frustration with that. I have a boat, 28-foot boat. I've graduated. I had a spinal cord injury 7 years ago, and my biggest concern learning to walk again was to get my butt on a boat and fish. That was my motive. That was had me in the gym day after day after day because I knew my life, I fish. So anyway, if part of this document is conservation. The Bolt decision clearly states that the burden of conservation shall fall equally upon all parties. So it is important in negotiations that this burden of conservation shall fall equally upon all parties. If we are off the water, the other user groups that are party to these treaties shall be off the water also. That is what Judge Bolt said. And I wish the state would, pardon the phrase, grow a pair and start negotiating in line with the treaties, how they have been written and interpreted since the Stevens treaties were signed. And in the past, I've worked diligently with restoring salmon habitat up to my butt in mud, pulling noxious weeds, planting native plants, clipping fins at hatcheries, working with the late, great Senator Bob Oak on fish and wildlife issues, working on the wild salmon policy, funding, walking the halls, talking to senators and representatives on fish and wildlife issues, funding, etc. At this point, with the most recent activity on the Puget Sound Management Plan, I'm ready to drive from Mill Creek to Olympia, along I-5 corridor through Seattle Federal Way, Fife, Tacoma, JBLN, and Olympia, a.k.a. the Highway to Hell, this January and February, discuss funding of WDFW with elected officials. I'm going to ask WDFW be defunded until they start representing the citizenry for sand management of the fishing and honoring the treaties for the non-native populations. There's no reason to defund a department that's not working for its citizens. I've also secured housing in Washington, D.C., and I'm calling scheduling appointments with elected officials, not only from Washington State, but anybody I can talk to that can remove any funding from Washington State. You may say I'm cutting off my nose to spite my face, but no, I'm tired for paying for resources that I cannot access. This is 100% due to the mismanagement and failure of WDFW to operate on behalf of the citizens in relation to the treaties. The Bolt decision was declined to be heard by the Supreme Court back in the 70s, and I believe enough circumstances have changed in 40 years, and I'm asking you, the Commission, to ask WDFW to revisit this and present this to the Supreme Court with the changed circumstances that we have. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your service.
You
Can we talk chumming? Is this the right session? Great, thank you. My name is Vaughn Hodgins. I reside at Summit Lake. I am currently the sitting president of the Summit Lake Community Association. You know, you have a lot of stuff on your plate, it's apparent. One of the things that we sort of have a lot of stuff on our plate at Summit Lake currently, right now we're under a water watch where children, and we've had another algae breakout, poisonous. So children, pets, and everything, the levels went up here about 2 weeks ago. This year, as the sitting president, we've had to foster probably a couple of months worth of no water for any of the residents out there, where 90% of the residents actually draw the water. I'm not an official or an authority on chumming, but what I would like to ask DFW is to postpone any decision on chumming at Summit Lake. You know, I'm not a fisherman. I may be off the dock a little bit when the grandkids and everybody come down, but we have been dealing for a year now with water quality, and what I'd like to ask is a postponement on any decision for chumming at Summit Lake. Now, that may sound like, you know, I'm really trying to be set aside, separate, or whatever, but, you know, I guess if you guys would go home and shut your water off for 2 months, you would realize the difficulty of having to take water containers down to a water truck, not showering. I mean, it's really disruptive. And I don't know chumming, but adding one more thing into our lake right now while we're working diligently on trying to figure out how we preserve our water quality, which is our drinking water, our bathing water, our clothes washing water. I'd like to ask that you would postpone any decision on chumming at Summit Lake. We are working diligently at trying to figure out, because it's very important to us. It's just like if the city of Olympia said they had poisonous water, everybody would work diligently at getting that resolved in the city of Olympia. We happen to be our own little city kind of out there. And to have the inconvenience of not having running water becomes very, very difficult. So if we could, I'd like to ask that you would at least sidebar any decision for chumming at our lake, because right now we've got the University of Washington wanting to work in cooperation with us, WDFW, Department of Ecology. We've been very, very involved this year with all these groups to try and figure out what's happening out there. And right now, to introduce one more thing when we haven't got a resolve just completely makes the matrix even that much more complex. So that's really what I'm here for. Everybody else seems to have a lot of things on their plate. Mine's pretty specific, and I hope it's easy enough to at least sidestep Summit Lake for chumming. And thank you very much, you guys.
Sure. We're going to have a discussion later today about our rule simplifications.
Is this public now, and that's for your group later?
Let's see.
Did I just get early?
It was on at 9:30, but we passed that. So.
It's good now that you said that. Yeah.
Okay. No, because I feel like our stuff is pretty small in comparison to everybody else's stuff, but it's very important to us, and it's... There you go. I don't want to be another, well, we're kind of another Flint. We're a secondary. But thank you very much for your time, you guys, and all your consideration in that regard.
Don, could you get a little closer to the mic, too? I'm having problems hearing, too.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. Now it's turned on. Just a comment on all the collective public testimony, which we had a considerable amount yesterday and have had more today. I know that people take a lot of time to drive a long way for their public testimony. Some folks from Mount Vernon today, some folks from the coast, And I just want to express some appreciation for all the testimony. A lot of time you all wonder whether or not what you say is being heard and what might happen and how much influence do you have really on from your testimony. I also know how difficult it is to squeeze things into 3 minutes. Very difficult. So anyway, I just wanted to say that at the end of the meeting under agenda item 18, we typically do go over the results of public testimony and talk about this. So it's often a question of when you testify, does it make any difference or not? And I just wanted to thank you all for your testimony and say that it does.
Thank you. And
you're set,
Pam?
Almost.
Oh.